mostly we fought negative battles, you know, trying to keep things from being worse. Well, now we've got a chance to be on the offensive for a progressive America. And again, having that opportunity won't last that long, so that's the urgency, and
right.
We must push it as hard as we can. We've got to push Obama, too, to be bigger and bolder and better than he even thinks he can be.
Right on. Okay, so I just want to say again, Jim, thanks so much for being willing to talk with us here.
Oh, my joy. Anytime. And good job. Enjoy visiting with you.
Great. And I've been talking with Jim Hightower, author of Swim Against the Current, Even Dead Fish.
Even a dead fish can go with the flow.
Right. And he'll be speaking tomorrow at a dinner with the ACLU. And people who want to get tickets can still do that. You can just call this number, 503-552-2109. And that's the ACLU Foundation of Oregon annual dinner. And they'll also be giving out some tremendous awards. So again, Jim, just thanks a lot. And we'll hope to see you tomorrow, okay?
Same here. Keep at them.
Okay, great. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, that was Jim Hightower. You can find out more about Jim at his website, jimhightower.com. And to find out more about the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, you can go to aclu-or.org. And finally, to purchase tickets tomorrow for the talk that Jim will be giving at the ACLU of Oregon, just call 503-552-2109. I'm Stephanie Potter, music by Kevin MacLeod, and you're listening to listener-supported KBRU Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
Tune into the KBRU Yiddish Hour on Sunday, March 29th, as we look at the concepts of eco-kashrut, a growing movement to reinterpret Jewish dietary laws. Eco-kashrut expands on traditional kosher practice by incorporating the ethics of sustainable growing systems, humane animal production, and fair treatment for farm workers. We'll be talking to some of the movement's primary shapers, as well as a couple of Portland's own Jewish organic farmers. So save the date, Sunday, March 29th at 10 a.m. right here on KBRU, and tell your friends.
Good morning, this is Robin Shanti for KBRU Radio. This morning I am speaking with Michael Schumann. Michael Schumann is the Director of Research and Public Policy for the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, also known as BALI, and the author of The Small Mart Revolution, How Local Businesses Are Beating the Global Competition. He's going to be a presenter this weekend at the Salem, next weekend at the Salem Convention Center at the Regards to Rural Conference on Friday, March 20th and Saturday, March 21st. Michael Schumann, welcome to KBRU. Michael, are you there? Well, we seem to be having some technical difficulty. I don't hear my guest on the line here. Oh, Michael, are you there? Oh, he's not hearing me for some reason. I apologize for
I am hearing you fine.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Hi there.
Now you can hear me.
Yes, I can.
Excellent. So, excellent.
It's a good morning here in Portland. So, Michael, number one, you know, we really need to talk about stimulus dollars and how those dollars are being spent and how we would like to see them spent here in Oregon. You're proposing that rather than the billions of stimulus dollars coming into the state and spending them on traditional economic priorities, which means recruiting outside businesses, big industrial parks, highway expansion, you're saying that our priority should be a lot different. What should that priority be and why?
Well, what we know about economic development is that the best kind of development is going to be rooted in locally owned businesses. There are a variety of studies that show that, you know, for every dollar you spend at a local business as opposed to a non-local business, you're getting something like 2 to 4 times the economic benefit. And that means 2 to 4 times the job impacts, 2 to 4 times the income and the wealth effects, 2 to 4 times as much in tax receipts. And additionally, we know from a bunch of studies that local businesses are really the best way of achieving the goals of smart growth, tourism promotion, Richard Florida's creative economy, civil society, trying to improve social equality, even political participation is enhanced by local business economies. So that's a very long list of positive things we know that local businesses contribute. And it seems to me that if stimulus is going to mean anything, it's going to be how do we maximize jobs, income, wealth, civil society, and so forth. What worries me deeply about the stimulus package is that none of the programs were vetted on this basis. There was no serious analysis of whether or not this or that category was going to maximize the multiplying of dollars within the beneficiary communities. And so now it really depends on the smart behavior of state and local officials to take these dollars and make sure that they're going into ideas for revitalization that are rooted in local business. Because if they don't do that, this money is going to be wasted.
Now, when we're saying local business, can you talk about the importance of the ownership, a locally owned business, and why Oregonian-owned businesses are key to your thinking?
Well, so locally owned business, let's first define the term. Local ownership means that a majority of the owners live within a tight geographic area around the business. So, you know, we could mean you live in Portland if it's a Portland business, or you can make an argument that we're talking about all of Oregon and it's an in-state business. But when something is locally owned, there are at least 3 or 4 things about it that we know happen that are different from a non-local business. So it's good to maybe just run through these quickly for your audience.
Sure. So
they appreciate the importance of this. So the first thing is that local businesses, unlike non-local businesses, don't move. They don't have any plans for moving to Mexico or Malaysia. And so a consequence of that is that if you invest, say, stimulus dollars in a business and it grows, you have confidence, if that business is locally owned, that all of the benefits are going to stick around your community. Whereas if it's not a local business, that business may take off with anything you gave it. And in fact, there was a study that I cite frequently that was done in Eugene around the economic development efforts of Jack Roberts in Lane County. And what they found is that, of the several million dollars that he had given out in tax abatements over the course of about 5 years, 95% went to 6 non-local businesses. 3 came, took the benefits, and within a year or two moved to Asia. 2 came, took the benefits, and never delivered the jobs they promised. The other 5% of the tax abatements went to about 100 locally owned businesses that made very modest promises and pretty much kept the promises that they made. And the bottom line was that the cost of a job from a non-local business was about 37 times more expensive than a job from a local business. Now, that is because of the unreliability of local businesses to stick around. The second point is that local businesses spend more of their money locally. And so that's why we get a much higher multiplier impact from those businesses. By multiplier, I mean that, you know, the more times that a dollar sort of moves around from transaction to transaction in the economy, and that the faster that it moves without any leakage, that's really the way you get more income, wealth, and jobs. And so there was this classic study that some in your audience may be aware of that was done in Austin, Texas, back in 2002, comparing the impacts of a $100 spent at a Borders bookstore versus $100 spent at a local bookstore. And $100 spent at the Borders led to $13 remaining in the local economy. $100 spent at the local bookstore led to $45 staying in the local economy. And what was the difference? The difference was, as the Borders didn't have a high-level management team on the ground getting salaries, the local bookstore did. The Borders didn't advertise on local radio and TV. The local bookstore did. The Borders didn't use local business services. The local bookstore did. And the Borders didn't have profits coming into the community, and the local bookstore did. So you can see that really the local ownership and the relationships that come from that is what facilitates more of that money being re-spent in the local economy. And I think the last thing that comes with local ownership is that locally owned businesses tend to have a size, usually small or home-based, and tend to have a character that's pretty unique that really make them fit better with a lot of other ideas around economic development. For example, tourism. You know, what attracts tourists to a place is its sense of uniqueness, not the number of chain stores. So, you know, those are really the underlying reasons why ownership matters.
Well, as we're talking about the economic stimulus coming into Oregon, we hear a lot of talk about creating sustainable jobs, quote unquote. And one company, for instance, Vestas, a lot of people have heard about that. It's a manufacturer of wind power. Can you talk about that and the fact that Vestas is not an Oregon-owned company?
Well, you know, and what this reflects is, I think, a peculiar character of Oregon. Oregonians are about the greenest thinking people in the United States. But at the same time, Oregonians are very, very conventional in their ideas around economic development. And I remember, you know, when the current governor was first elected and I heard him give a speech, and he said that his idea for economic development was to attract lots of great green product manufacturers from around the world to locate into Oregon. In that idea is both some of the most interesting cutting-edge progressive ideas around green manufacture and some of the most backward and counterproductive ideas about business attraction and economic development. So we really have to focus not on attracting outside business, but on nurturing and expanding existing business in Oregon that has the roots here, because otherwise you're not going to get all of the things, all of the advantages that I mentioned earlier. And so, you know, Vestas is like a textbook case of something that is producing good stuff and in that sense is good for the economy, but because it's not locally owned, it's really not that great a contributor to economic development in the state.
And I bet you the wind turbines aren't even manufactured in the United States.
Probably not. But, you know, let's put it this way. Even if you have a Vestas here, and I don't want what I'm saying to be interpreted as it's bad for Vestas to be here. It's not bad for Vestas to be here. It's just bad to put public money into bringing Vestas here.
Exactly.
And where that money should go instead should be for local companies that work with communities or households or businesses to do energy efficiency, to perhaps create their own micropower, to do the financing around micropower, to create miniature utilities. There's all kinds of business opportunities around there, out there, linked with the green economy, that don't have to depend on big outside businesses coming in.
And you can take the word stimulus and look at, you know, the meaning of stimulus is to stimulate growth. So why not invest in entrepreneurs from Oregon?
And indeed, I mean, there are so many fabulous entrepreneurs here and so many opportunities for investing in them. And I think what really makes me very, very nervous about the state's priorities right now is the state has just defunded all these business development centers around the state that support local business. And there's various other programs that support young entrepreneurs that they've defunded. Well, boy, talk about like the thing you least want to fund, you least want to get rid of, rather. It just seems that this state government has its economic development priorities exactly backwards.
I want to give folks out there an opportunity to call in and ask Michael Schumann some questions around this. The number to call is 503-231-8187. I'm Robin Shanti, and I'm speaking with Michael Schumann, the author of The Small Mart Revolution. Michael, I wonder if you could talk specifically about what the existing paradigm is. You know, for instance, a lot of us hear about, you were mentioning wanting to attract, you know, the model now is let's get another Intel into Oregon and we'll make sure they don't have to pay any taxes. And can you explain what that model is again, just so people understand
right
what they're comparing?
Well, so a couple of things to say on it. So first, the mainstream model basically says that the businesses we ought to care about are these big companies that trot around the world, and that the best communities will be those that encourage those companies to drop temporary anchor in our community. So, you know, the one version of the argument says, this is why we need good education and good infrastructure, because that will attract these cutting-edge global businesses. Another variation of the argument says, that's why we need to pay out incentives, why we need to give them tax breaks, because that will attract these cutting-edge global businesses. What the argument, I think, does not appreciate is that in doing so, in giving these advantages to these global businesses, you are disadvantaging all the local businesses that exist in your jurisdiction already. And not only that, but because those local businesses are actually the real source of economic prosperity in your community, that kind of strategy undercuts economic development. It does exactly the opposite of what it's purported to do. I'm just finishing a study now for the Kellogg Foundation where we looked at 15 states. Oregon was not one of them, but we looked at the three largest economic development programs in each of these states. And in all, we looked at about 84 program years, and we analyzed where exactly did the money go in each of these program years. And what we found is that in only 8 of the program years, that is about 10%, was a simple majority of the dollars going into locally owned business. That is, in 90% of the programs, something like 90% of the money was going to non-local business in the name of attraction or retention.
Well, we do have a caller on the line. Hi, caller. You are on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest.
Sure.
Are you familiar with publicly owned electric utilities run on a nonprofit basis? And what do you think about those?
Well, I think, you know, public ownership of utilities is a good thing in some respects, but not a panacea in others. I mean, I think that public ownership, cooperative ownership, nonprofit ownership, these are all variations of a theme that can link an entity to a place more so than you know, private ownership or certainly publicly traded ownership can. But I think as the Pacific Northwest learned during the, you know, fiasco around Bonneville and the Washington Public Power Supply System, where you guys, you know, tried to build a half dozen nuclear power plants and almost bankrupted the region, public power was as capable of making that kind of irresponsible mistake as was private power. So, you know, fortunately, public power does, you know, have more checks and balances, I think, that allows you to correct these mistakes once you uncover them, but they're still capable of making those mistakes.
Yeah, that's the worst example. The unsung examples that are positive in favor of public power, of which there is hundreds in the Northwest, of either city-owned municipals, cooperatives, or PUDs, utility districts, that day by day they offer utility rates that are anywhere from 15 to 35% lower right next door to for-profit traded corporations like Pacific Power, owned by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, and our PGE, which is traded on the stock exchange, which was formerly owned by Enron. So you're right, but I think really what you're saying is that if we have right now publicly traded utilities, that really we should look at keeping the money local and circulating in the local economy and having a nonprofit. Can I thank
you? Yeah, and so, you know, and I think certainly on the question of where is a dollar going into a utility, even if the performance of the public and the non-public and the private utilities were identical, which would generate the greater kind of economic development? And for all the reasons that I had mentioned earlier, the dollar that goes into the cooperatively owned or the publicly owned municipal utility is certainly going to lead to a much higher degree of economic development.
And can I just share one other thing, which is that the nonprofit, which is locally controlled by, let's say, an elected board of their neighbors, would do the thing that's contrary to a for-profit, which is, for instance, you can try to put yourself out of business. So to get rid of generating capacity, you could actually have every home with solar panels, try to have energy efficiency, give people insulation either at cost or a no-cost loan. This would be contrary to the profit motive, and I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, caller. If anyone else would like to give us your thoughts, the number is 503-231-8187. Michael Schumann, I'm wondering if you could also talk about the importance of really making a lot of the communities throughout a state, for instance, here in Oregon, self-reliant, and how that stimulus money could really help make those communities self-reliant.
Well, let me give you two positive, good news stories that I think stand in nice contrast to the depressing, you know, headlines about what's going on in our economy right now. So one involves energy. So picking up on the themes of the last caller, in the town of Gusing, which is in Austria, near the German border, Gusing was a 4,000-person town. Like many Oregon communities, its old economy was in forestry and agriculture. Its industries were, you know, being sunsetted by globalization. And so in the mid-1990s, a mayor was elected there who decided, you know what, we're going to take an unconventional approach to our economic development. We're going to try to become self-reliant on energy and build up our wealth from that and use that as a platform for taking the next steps in development. So they built a district heating system. That is, they had a centralized place where they burned wood that used to be in the forestry industry. And then they used that energy to sort of circulate heat among, you know, a couple dozen houses and businesses. Well, that reduced what they needed to import and outside oil, natural gas, and it reduced some of their electricity imports. Well, that gave them savings. With those savings, they were then able to reinvest in expanding the district heating system. And if we flash ahead about 15 years, they have created 50 new energy-related businesses. They have created 1,000 jobs out of those businesses. And most remarkably, they've done this and reduced their carbon footprint by 90%. That's the kind of trajectory of economic development that's possible with the clever development of self-reliance, even in one sector of the economy. So the second story is closer to home. It's from Vermont. And this was in a New York Times piece written by Marion Burroughs a couple months ago. But the community of Hardwick, another 3,000-person community, another community that whose agriculture was kind of suffering under the old paradigm of commodity agriculture, you know, decided to put a flag in the ground and said, we are going to be the best local food community in Vermont. And so, you know, they got together their farmers and their food people, and they started working together to improve the quality of their output. They created all these value-added food products. They created fabulous new restaurants, cheese manufacturers. They created a food incubator that is churning out new food businesses. And, you know, in 2 years, they've created about 100 jobs out of this new sector of the economy. Now, these are just, you know, food and energy are important sectors, but it's just, you know, they're just a modest percentage of what we spend our money on. And, you know, one can start spinning out that, gee, suppose we were to become self-reliant on finance. And what about clothing? And what about light manufacture? And what about more of our healthcare expenditures? And you start spinning through that and you realize there are all these incredible opportunities for communities to build up their wealth and become more self-reliant. And let me just add that self-reliance is often ridiculed as meaning cutting yourself off from the global economy. But in point of fact, what it really means is that by taking advantage of all of the cost-effective, you know, local goods and services that you can provide for yourselves, you then have the wealth to participate in the global economy more effectively.
Thanks, Michael. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, caller.
Hello.
Hello there.
Well, I wonder if there have been any tests or studies done on what happens when taxpayer money is used to sponsor big ballparks of one kind or another. And they claim that that's going to put money into our economy and create jobs. Is that what really happens?
Well, there is a researcher at Smith College who, and I'm forgetting his name, I think his name is Zimbalist or something like that, who has written a couple of books on the subject. And his conclusion is that these things are across-the-board major losers. It is the extremely unusual ballpark that pays for itself, let alone generates a very significant economic impact.
So as taxpayers, we should say no, no, no to this kind of boondoggle.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the one kind of sports franchise that has had really enormous payoffs kind of suggests another way of approaching this, and that is the Green Bay Packers. The Packers are the only team in the National Football League that aren't owned by a single obnoxious individual. And you know, the Packers many years ago organized themselves as a community stock-held team, and that's how the stadium is organized as well. And so by organizing the team and the stadium as these sort of public assets, as community-owned assets, they were able to actually make these things enormous wealth generators for the community. But if you don't do that, you end up generating a lot of wealth for the one individual who owns the stadium or owns the franchise.
Well, thanks. We've got one last caller. I think we'll have time to get on the air here. Hi, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for the show. And my question was, do the Intels and the Vestases in Oregon provide a educated workforce, somewhat like the universities do, and then those folks can spin off from those companies and then are, you know, locally owned businesses, basically?
Yeah. I missed the word about workforce before workforce. The what kind of workforce?
An educated workforce.
Educated.
I mean, more highly trained, like a university would help do in the community.
Well, I think there's no question that education and training and skills pay off in economic development. But the point is that too often we think about education as having an educated workforce, where I think, in fact, more and more of that workforce is going to have to be reconceived of as entrepreneurs. That is, you know, all of us really are beginning to think about, gee, do I need a second job to supplement my income? Even if I'm retired, do I need to come back and start making some new money? If I'm coming off of welfare rolls or coming out of prison, how do I begin to get myself back into wealth production? All of these things normally would lead us to look for a job with someone else, but those jobs aren't available. So I do think we're going to have to provide, you know, the capacity to help individuals at all scale, all levels of education, you know, better transform their ideas about business into, you know, successful business operations.
Michael, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have actually run out of time. I just want to let people know again that Michael will be speaking March 20th and 21st in Salem at the Regards to Rural Conference. And Michael, can you give your website if people would like to get more information about these ideas?
Yes, two websites. For my blog is www.smallmart.org. And for Bali, you can go to livingeconomies.org.
Thank you so much, Michael Schumann.
Thanks
for your phone calls. And stay tuned. I'm Robin Shanti for KBOO Community Radio.
And it is 10:01. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, 100.7 FM in Corvallis in Albany. And you can find us on the web at kboo.fm. Up next is Air Cascadia. Stay tuned to KBOO.
Good morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Today is Friday, March 13th, 2009. And this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Activists are gearing up for the peace march in Salem this Sunday.
The International Fisheries Commission weighs in on the science of salmon and sea lions.
That would be the Intertribal Fisheries Commission. And the G20 summit gets underway this weekend.
Portland area weather, increasing clouds later in the day, highs in the 50s. Tonight, cloudy, occasional rain, lows in the 30s and 40s. This weekend, rain, snow in the mountains, and lows around 35.
And first we go to headlines from around Cascadia. This Sunday, peace activists from across the state will converge in Salem to demand that Oregon's National Guard stay in Oregon. Michelle Daw will be on the steps of the Capitol, as she is every day and every night, to greet the peace marchers. Michelle, of all people, has made the most serious commitment imaginable, holding a vigil and a fast to bring the Guard home ever since last November. Michelle joins us this morning from Camp Homebound on the steps of the state capitol. Good morning, Michelle. How goes it down there?
Good morning, Chris. Things are going very well. We had a hearing the other day, and we have for the first hearing for House Bill 2556, and so that seemed to go very well. We had some very powerful testimony, as well as we are generating a lot of bipartisan support, and so there's some exciting momentum. And so we are really looking forward to this Sunday and Monday when there will be a legislative visit day and people will be converging on these 2 days to let the general population and their legislators know how they feel on this issue, which is of just urgency.
Well, briefly tell listeners, if you wouldn't mind, what the Bill 2556 actually is.
Well, what it is it's a bill that is the legislature giving the governor the support, backing and support to keep the Guard home in the event of an illegal deployment and to challenge an illegal federal deployment, a federal call-up of the Guard. And this has bipartisan support. It has most notably Chip Shields and Dennis Richardson as the primary people who are behind it.
Thank you so much for that, Michelle. We'll be seeing you then on Sunday. A lot of people from around the Portland area, I know, will be going down there. So we look forward to seeing you then. Thanks for being with us by phone this morning.
The Oregon National Primate Research Center has lost the latest round with PETA and other animal rights activists. The U.S. Department of Agriculture issued a warning letter to the Primate Center for violations of the Animal Welfare Act, which regulates treatment of commercial animals from kittens to guinea pigs. It may not seem like much of a victory, but compared with the Department of Agriculture does sweet nothing, it's a start.
Several major lenders have halted new foreclosures, but still the number of households threatened with losing their homes rose 30% in February from last year's levels. While foreclosures are highly concentrated in the western states and Florida, the problem is spreading to other states like Idaho, Illinois, and Oregon as the U.S. economy worsens. Apparently, even the American dream includes fine print.
The net worth of American households fell by the largest amount in more than 50 years of record-keeping during the fourth quarter of last year. The Federal Reserve said that household net worth dropped by a record 9% from the level in the third quarter. But that's just 95% of the population. Everyone else is doing fine.
Are these people trying to be funny? A billion-dollar rare money show is coming to Portland. Given that the state is currently running at a 10% unemployment rate, isn't all money pretty rare?
You can move a ton of freight 410 miles on a gallon of fuel on a train. That fact may be lost on most Americans, but not on people in Coos Bay. The Oregon International Port of Coos Bay will get $8 million from the feds to help build a rail line, or rather to buy the rail line that runs from Eugene to Coquille. That's not an earmark, that's just common sense. Without the line, area manufacturers have faced higher shipping costs by truck.
Salmon are running and emotions are running high over the sea lion issue. The Intertribal Fisheries Commission sees the animals as a problem, but has a different perspective and a different approach to solving that problem. With me this morning to talk about it are Sarah Thompson, Public Information Officer, and Doug Hutch, Senior Fisheries Scientist with the Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Commission. Good morning, Sarah. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning. Good
morning.
Thanks for being with us. Talk a little bit, if you will, about the Intertribal Fisheries Commission's approach to how they view the salmon situation, sea lions, and so forth.
Well, Chris, it's unfortunate that the sea lion predation problem has gotten so far out of hand that it has come to this. We understand that this has been a long process that has happened and occurred over the past 2 years, and that this is not an easy decision that has been made. The tribes are involved with the situation at Bonneville Dam through an active hazing program, and we're introducing some new technologies this year through research that we're really hoping will bring some insight into what exactly is going on.
So the tribes don't euthanize sea lions, or how do they handle it? What does the hazing consist of?
We're
involved in a non-lethal hazing program where you shoot projectiles. Basically, they're a firecracker that's shot out of a shotgun to try and spook the sea lions downstream. And then there's also underwater pyrotechnics involved as well, and trying to herd the animals away from the dam and downstream to where the fish aren't as concentrated and less vulnerable.
Yes.
The euthanasia is part of a Section 120 authorization through the Marine Mammal Protection Act that only the states are involved with.
Thank you so much for that. The hazing part sounds sort of, I don't know, fun. My guests are Sarah Thompson, Public Information Officer, and Doug Hutch, Senior Fisheries Scientist with the Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Commission. Thanks to both of you for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Wildlife officials put down their first salmon-eating sea lion. They killed the protected marine mammal with a lethal injection after a health examination determined that it could not be relocated to a zoo or aquarium. The California sea lion was on a list of 73 that habitually prey on endangered fish below Bonneville Dam. Next up, a list of humans who regularly prey on fish.
Sea lions are not. There won't be much of a salmon season for fishermen off much of the Oregon coast and the California coast for the second consecutive year. The Pacific Fishery Management Council adopted three options for this year's ocean salmon season in a meeting in Seattle yesterday. The options virtually shut down sport and commercial fishing off the coast of California and may offer limited commercial and sport salmon fishing in Oregon.
The Oregon House voted yesterday to end the Electoral College system in favor of the popular vote in electing a U.S. president. House Bill 2588 passed 39-19. Now it moves to the Senate. Four states have endorsed legislation to ban the current system, which awards all the Electoral College votes in a state to one candidate. Supporters say that they need this right now because presidential candidates spend too much time in toss-up vote-rich states.
The head of the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, an agency which few of us have ever heard of before, says he's improving the agency's approach to investigating hazards. This after residents of contaminated regions all across the nation told Congress yesterday that the agency's failings have imperiled people's health. Brad Miller, chairman of the House Science and Technology Subcommittee on Investigations and Oversight, says that the registry engages in, get this, poor science, reflecting a keenness to please industries and government agencies that prefer to minimize public health consequences of environmental exposures.
Progressives, don't get too comfortable. And be careful when you think about cannibalizing the Democratic Party. GOP Chairman Michael Steele is in Oregon for a party fundraiser. Steele says Republicans can win statewide elections, including the 2010 governor's race, despite Democrats' quarter-million voter advantage. And he could be right. The left has a track record when it comes to whining itself into irrelevance.
We're always shooting ourselves in the foot just when things are going well. The G20 nations meet this weekend. The topic, of course, is a financial meltdown. The question, though, isn't where did all the money go, but where did it come from in the first place? Other G20 member nations feel that they've added up enough stimulus for now. They want to see the world's banking system reformed. The U.S. wants more money poured into it. KBOO's Spencer Raymond joins us by phone this morning to make sense of it all. Good morning, Spencer.
Good morning, Chris. Yeah, you said it. There's really two camps have developed here inside the G20. And just a side point, the leaders of the G20, so that means the presidents, Obama, Gordon Brown, Sarkozy, those kind of the leaders, they're meeting on April 2nd. Who's meeting right now are the financial chiefs for the countries. Obama's top economic advisor, Larry Summers, is meeting with other G20 officials right now. On the question, is another stimulus needed? Is a worldwide coordinated stimulus needed or some sort of banking reform? The U.S., China, and Japan have jumped on board for this kind of coordinated worldwide stimulus idea. And if you remember, a couple months ago when this economic crisis started, China, along with the U.S., was one of the first to push a stimulus through. Japan is also suggesting a $200 billion stimulus in their own country. So it's Japan, China, and the United States. Those three should sound familiar because they're the top three economies in the world.
And Japan, of all nations, yes. Japan really ought to know where it's coming from on this issue.
Chris, they're at odds against Europe, who says, you know what, we've given enough money. Europe as a whole has committed about $40 billion total for the whole economic stimulus, while the U.S. is over close to $800 billion. So it's the European nations who think, like you said, we've put enough stimulus in. It's time to start reforming. Although the U.S. has some positive results they can report, I mean, Citibank just saying last night that it doesn't look like they'll need any more money. Bank of America also reporting yesterday that it looks like they're going to turn a profit here in the first quarter. So as far as U.S. banks are concerned, it seems like they're reaping the benefits from the bailout money, from the stimulus money. So it's going to be an interesting discussion as the G20 financial leaders meet.
Thank you so much for that. That, of course, is KBOO Spencer Raymond joining us as he does every weekday morning with DC Dirt. Thanks, Spencer.
A U.S.
Just the last few headlines here because it's important.
A U.S. missile strike destroyed a training camp in northwest Pakistan, killing 15 and wounding another 50.
And OPEC is meeting in Vienna this Sunday. They've got a tough choice. They could slash output to boost revenue, or they can risk deepening the world's financial woes.
Switzerland, the world's largest financial center, has agreed to accept concessions on bank secrecy.
And the European Union finance ministers have backed a call to double the money in the International Monetary Fund.
This has been headlines and commentary from Eric Cascadia for Friday the 13th, March 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Todd Wilson. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. Catherine Austin Fitz on Bernie Madoff, the permanent war economy, and a Bush administration executive assassination ring. Former CIA operative Ray McGovern discusses AIPAC and their attack on Chaz Freeman, and an interview with a human rights attorney from Haiti.
Thanks for listening and have a good day. See you in Salem.
Flashpoints, Catherine Austin Fitz takes a look at Bernie Madoff, the permanent war economy, and new revelations about a Bush administration executive assassination ring. Also, former high-level CIA analyst Ray McGovern speaks out against AIPAC and its attack against Chaz Freeman. An exclusive interview with the leading human rights attorney from Haiti on the violent conditions now facing political prisoners inside Haitian jails. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we are joined again by Catherine Austin Fitz for our weekly segment, called Community Business. Usually we hear Catherine on Wednesdays, but today, this week, we needed to get together on Thursday. Catherine, welcome back, and it's good always to have you with us on Flashpoints.
It's always good to be here.
All right, well, let's start with Bernie Madoff. He was in court. He pleaded guilty. He said he was very, very sorry about all the people that he hurt in what may be or may not be the largest, biggest single financial swindle. I doubt if it is, but
I doubt it.
It was certainly ugly, and a lot of people got hurt.
Yeah.
Now, we keep talking about one man, and of course, it makes sense that he goes from his penthouse to the jailhouse, but this was going on for a long time. Could it be there aren't other people who are engaged in this,
whose
names we might know all the way up the food chain?
There's no way that this could have been a Lone Ranger. It's impossible. And so